Last week, when it was the 50th anniversary of Robert Kennedy's assassination, he was remembered as a civil rights advocate. Well, it's more interesting than that. Robert Kennedy was not always a champion of the oppressed, but at least he was willing to listen. My next guest tells the story of a momentous meeting that happened in 1963. The book is called What Truth Sounds Like, Robert F. Kennedy, James Baldwin, and Our Unfinished Conversation About Race in America. The author is Georgetown sociology professor Michael Eric Dyson. Welcome back to KUOW.
Thanks for having me.
It was not just James Baldwin. Baldwin brought to this meeting with Robert Kennedy some of the best-known black artists of the day, Harry Belafonte, and
Lorraine Hansberry.
Why isn't this meeting more famous than it is?
That's what I said. I was like, man, I mean, given the temperature and tone of the meeting alone, but the attendees even more so, the theme and subject matter even more so. And you'd think, man, this would be talked about widely. It's discussed in books on Kennedy, a chapter maybe at most, pages here. And when I was reading it, I said, I want to read a book about it. I can't find one. Okay, I guess I better write one then. So that's why I wrote the book.
And in this meeting, it's not like Robert Kennedy slapped his thighs and said, oh, thanks, right. I agree. No. What actually happened in that conversation?
Yeah, he got really angry. They held him to account. Most politicians, I don't care what color you are, don't really want to be held to account. They say so, but they don't really want to be. White liberal politician, perhaps even more so on the issue of race, for which he is ostensibly known, or at least should be congratulated. He was looking for gratitude. He wanted the Negroes, as black people were then called, to express gratitude. With the Kennedy administration, we've done a lot more on race than anybody. That ain't really hard to do, because your predecessors didn't do a thing. I mean, piecemeal here and there. Eisenhower, Truman, you know, it was for show, it was a facade. So John F. Kennedy was playing both ends against the middle. On the one hand, he told black people, look, I'm going to try to support civil rights, but he wasn't putting any legislation forward. He found it difficult to get it through in a temperature and time in the country when Jim Crow was still reigning and black rights were not yet being fully realized. The March on Washington was 3 years off, so in 1960 when he was elected. So Kennedy, on the one hand, was telling black people that stuff, and on the other hand, he's promising the governor of Georgia, I'm not going to use federal authorities to intervene on segregation. Mm-hmm. So he's having it both ways. Bobby Kennedy is his attorney general, and even though he was fresh off of, in 1963, helping Martin Luther King Jr. behind the scenes negotiate a truce, in Birmingham, where the ghoulish Bull Connor had unleashed police dogs and fire hoses on black people who were protesting, he felt, look, I want to figure out why black people are being attracted to rage as opposed to nonviolence. Why are they listening to extremists, in scare quotes, within the black community and not the normal established leaders? He wanted to go to that meeting. He invited Baldwin and invited Baldwin to bring some of his friends. And when you're Jimmy Baldwin, your Rolodex looks like that. Mm-hmm. But he also brought Jerome Smith, a powerful, advocate for justice and a freedom rider, the most decorated, perhaps, along with John Lewis. He was beat to within an inch of his life on several occasions, mercilessly and savagely.
And he was pivotal in this meeting.
He was the center of that meeting, the linchpin. Because when he got there, Robert Kennedy said, hey, this is what we've done, rolled his sleeves up. We want to be careful. We don't want to alienate white voters because we've got an election coming up in 1960. Does that sound familiar? 2016 election. How do we get the white, alienated white people back? But let's forget the people who are loyal, who've been here, who have saved us, basically. That is in 2016. In 1963, black people, many of them didn't have the ability to vote. And those who did, of course, were loyal to the Democratic Party. But again, they were being sacrificed for the purpose of recruiting disaffected and alienated white voters. So that's the setting. Bobby Kennedy is there and the meeting explodes because Jerome Smith, the young freedom rider, said, I'm tired of the pity patter at this party. This is bull crap. I don't want to hear any of this. You're wondering why we're attracted to violence. I tell you what, why are you worried about the black Muslims? They'll never be active politically. That's not their shtick. Worry about a guy like me who's a devotee of nonviolence, but I'm ready to pick up a gun. And when I pick up a gun, that's it, brother.
And didn't Lena Horne basically say, We're nice. Listen to him.
That was Lorraine Hansberry. You're absolutely right. Lorraine Hansberry stood up and said, there are many, because he tried to pivot after Jerome Smith got in his cakes, so to speak. He tried to pivot toward the respectable, reasonable Negroes who were there. And Lorraine Hansberry said, there are many of us who are here who are great and nice, but the only man you should be listening to is over here. So Kennedy did not get let off the hook.
And they essentially were telling him, don't think of this as political horse trading.
Right.
You and your brother need to treat racial justice like the moral issue that it is.
That's exactly right. And they forced that on his awareness. He was resentful. He didn't like it. He was angry. He tried to talk back, but a couple of times, but they shut him down. So for 3 hours, he was stuck in that meeting listening to black people. Oh, my God, how horrible is this? Not talking, not prescribing, not giving bromides or nostrums, not platitudes, not giving stump speeches, not telling Negroes what they ought to do
explaining
and how they ought to
situation
handle it.
For them.
Mansplaining, white-splaining, race-splaining. Shut up, listen. And for 3 hours he did. Seething, upset, mad, but at least finally he listened. After he calmed down, he said to one of his aides, you know what? If I were black, I'd be angry too, perhaps. I'd think about the country the way they do. He began to talk about race as a moral issue. He encouraged his brother to do so when he gave that famous speech in June in the aftermath of the James Meredith attempt to get into the University of Mississippi, Ole Miss. He was talking about the moral dimensions of race. And Bobby Kennedy himself began to think about race in a far more complicated matter. And by the end of his life, he was known as one of the most, if not the most, trusted white men in America in regard to black people.
I'm talking with Michael Eric Dyson, whose new book is What Truth Sounds Like. And it's largely about this meeting, this conversation between Robert F. Kennedy, James Baldwin, Harry Belafonte, Lena Horne, Lorraine Hansberry, and others, as we said, activists. President Trump seems very impressed with celebrities. Could you imagine him meeting with Beyonce, Kendrick Lamar, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Toni Morrison, Oprah Winfrey, and Michael Eric Dyson?
Yeah, that ain't likely to happen anytime soon. No, he wants to meet with celebrities that he feels he can control, manipulate, dominate, exercise leverage over, or who will boost his ratings. When he talks to Kanye, he says, hey, talking to Kanye has boosted me. Black people love me. And then he's trying to pardon a couple of black people. Mostly
Kanye
dead.
West might have had a hand in that. Was it Alice Marie?
Yeah, Kardashian, his wife, Kim Kardashian, Alice Marie Johnson, who should have been let out of jail.
A nonviolent first-time drug offender.
I mean, in jail for life? Of course that was wrong. But it's not an individual approach, Mr. President. It's a systematic and systemic one. How can we deal with a system that puts black people there to begin with, vulnerable people there to begin with? But no, I can't imagine Mr. Trump sitting down with lively, intelligent people of any stripe or ilk, much less those who are African-American and throw in there a couple of football players, maybe Colin Kaepernick or, Malcolm Jenkins or Michael Bennett. And no, it's a wash.
When we talk about the celebrities and politicians, what did you think of Robert De Niro saying F Trump at the Tonys while people are standing and cheering?
I mean, this is what it's come to. I'm usually for civility and comity. I believe that people should deport themselves with exemplary, respect for the other. I still do. But, we're at such a point that a figure like Robert De Niro, the godfather himself as a young man, saying this about Trump is more than an obscenity and an epithet hurled at another human being. It's about speaking some truth, some anger, some rage against power and the unjust exercise of it and the refusal to concede the legitimacy and humanity of so many people, African-Americans, Mexicans, Muslims, women. This is a president who is extremely distressing. And De Niro felt that he had to take that extraordinary step. And for those right-wing brothers and sisters who are so upset, wow, you weren't upset when Obama was being called the N-word or being called an ape or an orangutan or a monkey or his wife being treated that way and all kinds of vicious death threats and assaults made upon them. I mean, this is the nation in which we live. And unfortunately, the intolerance for the other has become the hallmark of this particular administration.
Did you expect to hear more from Barack Obama now than we're hearing?
Yeah, he's out there making that money, I guess, man. I don't know. You got to get paid. I get it. I'm not mad at you getting your paper, getting your money. But where are you? You know, the excuse that black people used to hear when he was in office is, well, you know, it's tough. He's a black man. He doesn't want to be painted into a corner as the black guy and be ghettoized. Okay, that was ridiculous. But okay, if that's what your excuse was, what's your excuse now? What are you doing now? Are you the president? Oh, you're the ex-president. Oh, you could talk. Oh, you're free. Now, you might compromise your money and your economic stability, but I mean, you are who you are. And Obama was disinclined, even in office, to address race directly and has been loath to do so since leaving and hasn't even spoken out against what we see going on here. Now, in the book, you know, Ben Rhodes' new book, you know, what about if we were wrong or if we were ahead of the game and so on? Yeah, but where's your concerted effort to articulate a vision that could rally progressive people in the gap until somebody else comes along who more reflects a broader variety of difference and tolerance for people, even across the aisles, Republican or Democrat, left or right? And it's extremely disappointing to hear his silence.
Speaking of addressing race, could you see yourself backing Howard Schultz for president?
Hey, you know what? I certainly could. Bring it on. He probably is thinking about it, right?
So they say.
That's why he left Starbucks, and that's why he's doing his thing. So,
what did you think of the Race Together campaign and the closing stores for racial bias education?
It's important. It can't solve it by itself, but it's a step, and we have to make steps. And he did something, I think, valuable and something insightful and something worthy of support and consideration. And, you know, I like Kamala Harris. I like Eric Holder. I like, you know, Kristen Gillibrand. I mean, I like a lot of these folk who are out here thinking about running. Cory Booker. I mean, we've got a nice bench. Can we really contest what this man is doing? Because more than people think, I think President Trump has an excellent chance of reelection, which is horrifying to me, to say the least.
Since we brought up Howard Schultz, you know, Seattle is a politically progressive city.
Mm-hmm.
But right now we're fighting over what progressive means. There's a lot of frustration about income inequality and gentrification and homelessness.
Right. Right.
What's your experience with Seattle? Take on Seattle?
Well, Ezell's chicken is great. I know that.
Or maybe, you know, cities like Seattle. What do you think of this argument? Liberal progressive talking to one another.
Yeah, well, it's like Bobby Kennedy, isn't it? It's always nuanced. It's always complicated. It's great. Look, I'm nostalgic for a time when we could have debates with, you know, among progressives and liberals and those who are to the left and those who are further to the left. That's a beautiful thing in light of what we're dealing with now. So I don't gainsay or naysay that. I think it's important. But when we challenge people to think critically about how you talk about it as a principle and how you live it in your life, that's what we're closing that gap. Whether it's the homeless people who dot the landscape of this elegant liberal city, the progressive politics notwithstanding, you know, how we're addressing the issue of race and racial inequality. And, you know, in a place like Seattle where you don't have a deep concentration of black people, it's perhaps easier to be liberal on race than to live with black people and have to share resources. Really? I mean, that's why white working class people find themselves in tough positions, because they're fighting over what they perceive to be scarcer and scarcer resources with African-American people who they think don't deserve them. And they're in direct competition with them. When you're white and liberal and well off, your kids are not competing with black kids to get into school. Your schools are not being challenged in a post-busing era to be more open and equitable. And if you are, there's not a density of demographics to challenge your position and so on. So I think it's extremely important that a city like Seattle, dealing with the diversity that is here, not just black and white, but when you think about both Latino and when you think about Pacific Rim and Asia and the Asian American identity here, this is a very powerful city in that regard. You know, I come here and speak often with the principal of Franklin High School, Jennifer Wiley. Dr. Jennifer Wiley is doing an amazing job. One of her students was just killed in a horrible event. They're making his casket themselves.
He was killed. He was out ghost hunting, playing right in a park nearby, Martha Washington Park.
Exactly right. What, 17 years old? And, Dr. Jennifer Wiley, to me, is an exemplary principal, an activist who puts her life on the line, who thinks about it. That's the best of Seattle to me when I think about what this city represents. And you've got to continue to struggle with liberal and progressive principles and how they are lived out, how we close the gap between ideals and realities, as T.S. Eliot might frame it. So it's extremely important. And in an era of Trump, when we've had such an abdication of responsibility for even thinking about these issues, for even being challenged by them, for even thinking they're worthy of discussion, that's where we are right now. So a city like Seattle, regardless of its faults and flaws, to me, will always be a beacon, especially in times like this.
Michael Eric Dyson is the author of the new book, What Truth Sounds Like, Robert F. Kennedy, James Baldwin, and our unfinished conversation about race in America. Thanks for coming to Seattle, coming to KUOW.
Thank you, my friend. Always great to be here.